You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Horace Mann is a school so renowned for academic excellence that generations of Manhattan parents have happily commuted their children to its northern Bronx campus. But as it turns out, for decades, from the 1960s through the 90s, a number of students were sexually abused by teachers there, and its administration appears to just look the other way. This past weekend, a settlement was announced for many of the abused students after a mediation that took place at the school. In an article called The Master, which is in this week's New Yorker, Mark Fisher, a senior editor at the Washington Post, and Horace Mann, an alumnus, describes one of the more charismatic teachers at the school and the devastating hold he had on his students. Mark Fisher joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
How did you feel about the announced settlements? Did you attend the mediation proceedings?
No, we weren't permitted to. The mediation was open only to the victims, their lawyers, and the lawyers for the school, plus their insurance agents. And the settlement is rather disturbing because it's not yet clear that it will result in what the victims of abuse were looking for beyond money, which is an independent investigation into what happened at Horace Mann and why, an apology, and the removal of some of the teachers' names from prominent positions around the school. So that remains unclear, and it's also what has become clear from the mediation is that quite a number of the students, the alumni, were really lowballed by the school and given insultingly small settlements, as well as they were treated rather shabbily by the school's representatives at the mediation. So this mediation, rather than settling things, has really exacerbated the tension between the alumni and the institution.
Well, none of the current administration was at the school during the time this abuse occurred, and they've argued that their funds should be used for the education of the current student body.
And that's largely true. I don't think any of the alumni would argue that what happened from the 1960s through the 1990s could or is happening today at Horace Mann. The school, like many such schools across the country, has really taken the abuse issue to heart and has instituted all kinds of protections as well as training for teachers. So there's no argument that what happened in the past is or even could be happening now. The argument is that this is a school that taught its students over the decades to value truth and inquiry and critical thinking, and so the idea that we would simply sweep these abuses under the rug is really something that does not sit well with Horace Mann alumni, and so there is this rift that has developed between the alumni and the school. The school wants to simply move forward, and the alumni say, well, that's fine, but you should also take part in just a simple inquiry into what happened and why. What was it about the culture of this place that allowed so many teachers to be so inappropriate in their behavior to students?
Wasn't part of the process that they would get to tell their stories? Why were the proceedings kept closed?
Well, the school has been very protective of its image throughout this these last months, and the school was reluctant at first to go to a mediation. They were talked into it, and the deal was made on the proviso that there be a media blackout, and so neither side was permitted to speak to reporters, although in the end both sides broke that agreement. But the initial conditions for the mediation were very strict, and the school has been very cautious about its public face. In fact, through the 8 or 9 months that I was working on the story for The New Yorker, the school completely refused to speak to me in any way, shape, or form. All requests for comment to trustees, to administrators, were turned to a PR firm that simply said they had no information.
When did you attend Horace Mann?
I was there from 1970 to 1976, which is pretty much the heart of when most of the allegations, most of the alleged abuses took place.
And it was an all-boys school at that time?
Yes, I was in the last all-male class. And so almost all of the alleged abuses took place during the all-male era. There were a few that took place afterwards, and primarily involving the same teachers who were accused in the all-male era. But that all-male piece was, if not a cause of the abuse, it was certainly a reason that the abuse was able to stay in the shadows. There was a culture of silence at Horace Mann and at similar schools that were kind of modeled after British boarding schools. There was this notion that what happened at Horace Mann stayed at Horace Mann. But the boys, to be serious, really did not go home and tell our parents about some of the weird and creepy things that were happening at school. It was only after coeducation, when girls came into the school, that girls went home and they did tell their parents about these things, and those parents came in and raised hell. And over the first 3 or 4 years after the school went co-ed in the late 70s, many, if not most, of the teachers involved in these allegations were removed from the institution.
Were you aware of what was going on? Had you experienced any kind of inappropriate behavior, or did any of your friends confide in you about something untoward that had happened to them?
You know, this is really the heart, the kernel of what got me interested in this story, because back in high school, and it's hard to put yourself back in an adolescent mindset and remember what things looked and felt like when you were a teenager, but what we knew and the stories that we then told our college roommates and friends in the years that came after was that there were really strange things happening at Horace Mann, and we probably didn't know the details of sexual liaisons between students and teachers. But we knew that there were students who were extremely and uncomfortably close to teachers. We knew that there were teachers who took boys home for the weekend. We knew that there were boys who came in on Mondays boasting about having slept on the mats on the floor of a teacher's living room. We knew that there were boys who were seen kissing teachers. And so all of this was maybe a step or two above the rumor level, and it was enough for us to talk and whisper among ourselves, and we also knew that there was something wrong about it, and that was probably part of the reason we didn't go home and tell our parents. A few brave boys did complain to teachers, to administrators, and even to trustees of Horace Mann about sexual abuse, and they were rebuffed. They were told, you can't prove this. This would be highly damaging to you if you pursued this kind of allegation. And so they didn't know of each other's existence, and they lived in these isolated silos of pain where they knew that abuses had taken place.
And that sounds like the same sort of thing that we've heard in relation to a number of different religious institutions. Are there similarities?
A number of people have drawn that parallel to the Catholic Church, and
we've also seen it in the Hasidic community and some charismatic church communities. Wherever there is a sense that there's a fortress that has to be protected.
And what these institutions and subcultures have in common is this sense of being a world apart from the rest of society, a place where something special is happening, and that specialness has with it some things that are socially unacceptable in the rest of the world. And that was very true of Horace Mann. Horace Mann presented itself to us as a school where we were being trained to be some sort of elite that would govern the city and be in the major institutions of finance and law and so on. And with that sense of being an elect or an elite of some sort was this notion that there were things that happened at Horace Mann that were different, and we didn't need to explain them to the rest of the world. And that gave a kind of cover for the school, just as for those religious institutions you spoke of, where these kinds of unacceptable behaviors were not spoken of. And Robert Berman, the teacher I write about, is a prime example of that. He had a cult of sorts that was ostensibly an intellectual and artistic one, but had this sexual undertone to it that was never spoken about publicly.
And you've called your article The Master, which reminds people of a film about a cult leader. It's in the current issue of The New Yorker. But did you become aware of the dimension of the problem when you read Amos Kamil's articles about the abuse in the New York Sunday Times magazine about a year ago?
No, I knew much of what was in Amos Kamil's excellent story for the Times Magazine last June. What that story did is it broke the wall of silence, and there was this just tremendous outpouring of interest and concern from Horace Mann alumni through the decades from the moment that story was published. Because while these were things that we had whispered among ourselves about and gossiped about, for a well-reported, thorough story like that to be published, naming names and making clear that this was not one or two teachers but a more widespread problem, really broke the wall of silence and paved the way for the kind of reporting that I was able to do with this story. And what happened is, after the Times Magazine story came out, a number of the alumni came to me and said, that was a fabulous story, but it was about four teachers, all of whom are dead. And some of the more egregious cases involved teachers who are still living. And the most egregious case involved Robert Berman, the English teacher, who was not mentioned in the Times Magazine story, but who had this cult, and and there were a number of alumni who were alleging sexual abuse on Berman's part. And to boot, there were a number of alumni who had stayed with him for decades after Horace Mann. In fact, they had gone out and bought a mansion for him and lived with him for decades, and one does to this day, in Tuxedo Park, New York. And so this was not just a high school cult, but really a legion of men that continued for decades.
His cult and influence reminded me of the Dead Poets Society, only creepier. But you took a class with him, didn't you, and dropped out after one day?
Yes, very briefly, and although that may sound strange, that was actually a very common occurrence at Horace Mann. Mr. Berman's classes started out at the normal size of somewhere between 15 and 18 students, and by the end of the first day or two, his classes were always down to perhaps a half a dozen or eight students. And the reason was his performance on that first day, where you would walk in and there would literally be 5 to 10 minutes of silence, which is very unnerving, if not creepy, to a teenager. He would sit there in his shaved head and sunglasses and thin tie, tweed jacket, and stare at us, smoking very intently on his Benson and Hedges. And eventually he would finally stand up and do this performance where he would reach to the very top of the wall, draw a line on the wall with chalk, and say, "This is Milton." And then he'd drop his hand down a few inches lower and draw another line on the blackboard and say, "This is Mahler." And then continue on down every few inches, "This is Browning," and so on, his heroes. And then he would let the chalk drop to the floor and very ostentatiously grind it into the floor with his heel and then say, "And this, gentleman, is you." And that kind of creepy performance would, along with all of the atmospherics of his classroom, drive a number of students every year to go and immediately ask for a transfer to a different English teacher. And those were always granted, no questions asked.
Well, why did the administration and his fellow teachers tolerate that? He wound up with a small class. And obviously, if a lot of kids were dropping out, it meant that he wasn't necessarily the best teacher.
Well, he had a magnetic and inspiring effect on those who remained, those who bought into his appeal and were captivated by his love of art and literature and music, got a lot out of this course. In fact, many of them were inspired to go spend their lives and devote their careers to art and literature, and many of those people credit Berman with having set them on that course. The school tolerated him because they thought of him as as an odd genius, a brilliant man who they were lucky to have in their midst. And when parents and students would go complain about him, that was the response. The response was always, we are lucky to have him here, and we will tolerate his oddities because of that. And Horace Mann had a number of teachers who were similarly odd in one way or another, and those eccentricities were more than tolerated. They were celebrated in the school, because this was seen as a variety of ways to draw students into the world of ideas and knowledge, that there were many paths, and each teacher was permitted to create his own world within the walls of his classroom.
Well, one of his habits was to make up lists, and as you said, Milton at the top, above Shakespeare. When he talked about movies, he said Lawrence of Arabia was beyond being a judge for a list, so that was the greatest movie ever made. That's bad teaching, telling people that there are those kinds of hierarchies, because it seems to me good teaching is encouraging people to make their own hierarchies based on how they interact with art.
That's true, and this no one would argue that Horace Mann during those years was a progressive education. This was a very top-down, hierarchical kind of education, and Berman was the epitome of it. He had lists for everything from the greatest art repositories in the world to the six greatest newspapers in Austria, and students competed to get these lists, and he even sold copies of the list to students. It was brilliantly designed to appeal to the adolescent male mentality. These lists had star ratings for every composer and every painter and every writer who he had blessed with a position on his hierarchy. And it was like baseball cards for the intellectual world.
And he included himself in a list of the 1,000 most important people ever, above some pretty important people.
Yes, he announced to one of his victims of sexual abuse at one point that he had just risen above Melville to number 27 on the 1,000 greatest men of all time, some gall you would think, but he had this extraordinarily high opinion of himself and would often boast about having read 90% of the greatest works ever written and having somehow been involved in the writing of the other 10%.
My guest is Mark Fisher of The Washington Post. His article called The Master is under a reporter at large in the current issue of The New Yorker. And we'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with senior editor at The Washington Post, Mark Fisher, also an alumnus of Horace Mann High School. Is it called high school? Prep school?
I guess they would call it a prep school. It's more than a high school now. It's kindergarten through 12th grade, although when I was there it was 7th through 12th.
And Mr. Fisher has written an article called The Master, subtitled A Charismatic Teacher Enthralled His Students. Was he abusing them? Although, as you point out, he wasn't the only one. And you say that Tech Young Lin, who was quoted on the front page of the Times piece, is saying, everything I did was in warmth and affection and not a power play. It did not seem really wrong. He was one of your favorite teachers. Well, how did you feel about him after you learned that?
Well, it is a very difficult transition to make from adoring a teacher such as Tech Young Lin, who was an English teacher who I went so far as to acknowledge in one of my books as having inspired my love of language and helped me learn how to write, and to then learn that he not only admitted having sex with students but basically didn't see anything wrong with it was very disturbing. And there are ever since last summer when the Times Magazine piece first appeared, there have been literally thousands of comments in Facebook private groups of Horace Mann alumni who are trying to cope with, trying to work through this contradiction between the teachers who were most inspiring to them turning out to be those who abused their classmates. And actually, this turns out to be pretty much the standard profile of a teacher abuser. They're the few major studies that have been done of teacher abusers have all concluded that there is some connection between that inspirational, charismatic nature of a teacher and those who are most likely to end up having abused kids. And so some of that charisma, some of that inspirational aspect of the personality is part of the grooming process where the teachers identify students who may be possible victims and then bring them into their circle.
Well, did Tech Young Lin note that these boys were not always 18 and over? He was breaking the law. In fact, anybody who was having sex with somebody under 18 was breaking the law, wasn't he?
Absolutely. And the cases that we knew about when we were in high school of teachers and students having relationships all involved, obviously, students who were under 18, but they appeared at the time to be, at least the ones that were more public, appeared to be, for lack of a better term, consensual. Now, of course, many would argue that there's no such thing as a consensual relationship in a teacher-student affair, or particularly in a teacher-student affair with a minor. But these were relatively open relationships in that the teacher and student would be seen going off together by themselves, taking trips together, kissing, embracing, that sort of thing. But far more of the cases that we've learned about in the last year were very much quiet and secret. And those, we have to conclude that at least the teacher knew that there was something that would be disapproved of in those relationships. Although I do have in the story a Horace Mann alumnus who is a sociologist who was at the school in the 1960s who argues that this was a different time. It was a time of sexual experimentation. It was a time of cultural upheaval, and that there was somehow a higher tolerance for that kind of behavior, which we now think of as having zero tolerance for in schools today.
We have a call from a Horace Mann alum, Robert from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I was at Horace Mann myself from the early to mid-70s, and I left after the 10th grade just because I found it it was intolerable, the overall atmosphere. But
In what way, Robert? Why did you find it intolerable?
It was oppressive. I found a few teachers that I really liked, but overall it was hyper-competitive, not necessarily in a good way, and very strange, in part because of the faculty. On the one hand, there were some really brilliant people there.
Did you have friends in Berman's class?
Yeah, I did. I had one friend after I left. I went down to the UN school, which is totally different. And part of it, too, by the way, was there were no girls in the school, which made it, I think, exacerbated the atmosphere. But I remember the year after I left, the 11th grade, a friend of mine called, and he told me just off out of the blue that he was listening to Mahler's Ninth Symphony, and it made him feel so insignificant.
The influence of Berman. I guess a lot of kids were made uncomfortable by that atmosphere. Did a lot of people, did a lot of people leave the school?
No, there were a few like the caller, but very few. In fact, my class from 7th through 12th grade remained, I would say, at least 95% intact, and it was rare for students to leave. There were those, however, who stayed and were very much unhappy and very stressed out or repressed in one way or another. But for many of us, that sense of competition was something that we found thrilling and exciting. So it hit people in different ways, but it was clearly a very competitive atmosphere. On the other hand, there was a closeness among the boys that many of the alumni value to this day. And part of the contradiction, part of the paradox that we've seen in the last year is that there's a sense of shame that maybe we could have done more, maybe we could have said something about the abuses that were going on, and yet there's also this connection that people are discovering among their classmates that that remains strong despite or perhaps even because of these allegations of abuse.
My guess is Mark Fisher. His article, The Master, is in the current issue of The New Yorker. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How did Berman select and seduce his victims? They seem to be atypical of stories like this. In most of the situations we see where there's the similar scandals, there's usually a socioeconomic aspect to the story, where a vulnerable kid, a kid who is being ignored by his parents, winds up being called his favorite by the teacher. Do we see similar things here?
Well,
these are rich
part,
kids, aren't they, most of them?
It was a mix. He did tend to pick students, curiously, whose fathers had also gone to Horace Mann, which made it fairly likely that they were affluent, and a number of them were. So it was not a socioeconomic factor, I think, that helped him with his selections. But there was a vulnerability that the victims had in common, and you're very much on point there, because Berman had, as many abusers do, a sixth sense of who was emotionally troubled, who was perhaps going, their parents going through a divorce. A number of his victims, the father had recently left the house, and so Berman would befriend the students over those kinds of issues. He would invite them in after class and ask them about how things were at home, and he would very much take their side against their parents and would often lecture them about the mediocrity of their parents, as he called it. And he would talk about the parents being bourgeois and having too much of a materialistic world view. And he presented the world that he offered as the beautiful and truthful alternative to that more mercenary approach that he said that their parents had. And so he presented the world of art and literature and music and ideas as the alternative, as the higher plane where the students could live away from their mercenary, mediocre parents.
And he flattered them. He compared them to Dickens and great poets. Gene, one of the kids you talk about, seemed to feel he was a bit of an intellectual inferior. And then Berman said that he actually was going to be a great poet. Another kid you write about, Stephen Fife, he compared to Dickens. Fife rebuffed him when he made a play. And yet the next year he took three or four of his classes.
Right. And so there was this very enticing offer that Berman was making to these students. The people he singled out for abuse tended not to be among the very best students. They tended not to be among the most achieving students. Rather, they were from the middle of the pack, and they were people who had a sense of, if not inferiority, at least a lack of confidence about their intellectual abilities. And he would tap into that and say, hey, you are great. You are the next Dickens. You are somebody who whose poetry I want to publish in the school literary magazine. And then he would do that, and that was his way of making these kids feel as if they were different and special, and making them believe that only Berman saw this in them, and only Berman had the ability to bring out in them this brilliance that had heretofore gone completely unremarked upon at the school. So that made them connected to him and dependent upon him in a very important way, and then Berman was able to take it from there and say, look how much I've done for you, now you need to do something for me. And he would often use those words. What can you do for me was often the introduction to the first sexual act.
Did you ever get to speak with Berman for your article?
Not in the official definition of the word speak. I called many times, and I was told by a young man who lives at his house that Mr. Berman does not speak on the telephone, but that he would engage in a correspondence by fax only. And so we had an odd series of faxed letters back and forth in which I spelled out all of the allegations and asked him to respond and asked him about all of the people who were accusing him of abuse, and he responded in his very arch, inimitable, and rather baroque language, in which he basically said that he had never had any sexual contact or interest in any of his students. In fact, he denied any of the extracurricular activities with students. He says they didn't come to his house. He says he didn't meet with them after school.
And that he didn't beat somebody with a belt buckle, although
right.
He gave you a rather arch response to that accusation.
Yeah, he said that might be an excellent idea. His responses to me were typical of the way he would speak to students. He was at times almost incomprehensibly dense in his responses, and at other times he was clearly playing with us. And so we were able to run a number of these allegations past him and get his responses, which are included in the article. Essentially, they are denials of any influence on his students. Not only does he deny sexual contact, he denies having any of the inspirational effect on his students that many professors across the country who came out of his classes credit him with.
Now, Andrew Solomon had a very different take on the school. In his book, Far From the Tree, he discusses the scandal at Horace Mann and his experiences there as a student. He experienced it as a radically homophobic place, and he said the New York Times article saddened him because some of the accused teachers had been kinder to him than anyone else at the school during a desolate period of his life. He said that students talked monstrously to and of their gay teachers because the prejudice was so endorsed by the school community.
Well, I spoke with Andrew Solomon for this story, and his view is, I think, partly right. Homosexuality was simply not spoken of at Horace Mann. It was a different time. It was an all-boys school. It was a school that was unusually tolerant of gay teachers. In fact, probably upwards of half of the faculty were gay themselves at a time when it was very difficult for homosexual teachers to get employment in the public schools.
Were there any women teaching at the school?
Just a couple. Just during the all-male era, there were really just two women teachers.
But Solomon said he was called a faggot everywhere in front of his teachers.
And that is I certainly don't doubt him on that, and that is tragic and wrong. But I think it needs to be examined in balance with the fact that the teaching staff was heavily gay, and that was not an issue for most of us the majority of the time. There may have been some incidents where people used slurs like that. I wasn't aware of them, but certainly if Andrew says there were, then I take him at his word. But I think it's equally remarkable that in that period in the 1970s, gay teachers were out in many ways at Horace Mann, and even those who were not out were functioning in a way that was satisfying enough that they stayed there for 30, 40 years at a time. And so there was this culture of silence about sex, and that weighed heavily on boys at an all-boys school. And the boys who were gay at the time at the school were often felt alone and adrift.
Now, we have some sad stories here. One of Berman's victims, Doug, wound up killing himself. We hear about that in situations where there's been sexual abuse. But the New York City police have been investigating charges of sex abuse at Horace Mann, and I wonder where that goes. Haven't most of these cases passed the statute of limitations?
Well, that's the difficulty, and the police and the prosecutors have spent many months now looking into these allegations, and they have concluded from what they told me that these allegations are true. They believe the victims, and they believe that the teachers committed crimes. The problem is that the New York state law requires a person to report sexual abuse within 5 years of becoming, of reaching the age of majority. And so basically, if these students hadn't reported this by the age of 23, they had no right under the law to do so in either a criminal case or a civil case. And that is the law that has allowed Horace Mann to play such hardball in the mediations that just ended on Friday, because the school was able to say, hey, you have no legal recourse. The statute of limitations has long since passed. When I spoke to the police and the prosecutors, they were extremely frustrated that they had amassed all of this evidence and simply could not find a legal theory that would allow them to move forward. And when I asked, well, what are you going to do with all of this? What can be done? One of the officials told me there's really very little we can do. At this point, the only thing that can be done is journalism.
Did you send your son to Horace Mann?
Well, I live in Washington, so I didn't have to face that question, but actually I would have. I got a great education at Horace Mann, and I, like even many of the victims of abuse, a couple of whom do have children at Horace Mann today, they believe that the school has changed quite dramatically, and that it is a very much more healthy place. It is a place that would not tolerate this kind of behavior, and it is a place that would be aware of and open about such behavior. So it has changed, as have many such schools, but that does not relieve the school of its responsibility toward its alumni and toward its history to look into what happened and why.
Mark Fisher is a senior editor at the Washington Post. His article, The Master, A Charismatic Teacher Enthralled His Students, Was He Abusing Them?, is in the current issue of The New Yorker. Thank you so much for being on our show.
I'm happy to do it. Thank you.